Tim is going to get started, but just so everybody knows, welcome to this session. This is Tim Wilbrecht.
Thanks, Frank.
He's talking to us this week about telling our sacred stories, both in a personal context and also what that means at Holden Village. And we're so happy to have him with us. And there it is. Just so you all know, this session is being recorded. So anything you say will be on the tape and on our archive section of our website. So feel free to participate or not participate based on that information.
We're good. That's the background. This is so fun. That's for Sam. Thank you.
So thanks, Tim.
Well, we'll see. Hi, everybody. Some of you know me. Like she said, I'm Tim Wilbrecht. I do intentional interim primarily, which means I work with congregations of the everlasting hope that one sweet day will be as good as it used to be. That's the type of work I do. This isn't working totally because I need to see what's all going on. Right. All right, we do have an issue because I have a video up here.
Oh yeah, we're extended again, so let's do another update.
All right, I'm going to start talking while he starts extending, whatever that means. So, this is actually part one of three parts. You're welcome to be present at any of them, or all of them, or none of them. But you're here. There you go. Now let's just hope it works when I need to use it.
Okay.
These three sessions, I'm going to talk briefly about story. We're going to identify what a sacred story is. And then the next session has to deal with what happens in our stories when we come face to face with change. And I figured that Holden hasn't had much change going on in the last few years, so I thought maybe that'd be something to talk about. I do this with congregations because they are pretty well messed up when I go in, so I have to do something that has to do with change and transition. And the same change and transition aren't the same, so we'll do that on Wednesday night. Okay, so this is about story, so I'm going to define what sacred story is. So what comes to mind when you hear the word sacred story?
Bible.
Thank you. Anything else? What?
Bible.
What else?
Tradition.
What else?
God.
I'm sorry?
God.
Say it again.
God.
All right, thank you. I have a cold. So you might, when I lean like that, it means I'm not here. Anybody else? We're all good.
History.
Good. What else?
Myth.
Oh, I like that. Very good. Nice. My question then is, what makes a story sacred?
Something that has a deeper underlying meaning.
Ooh, can you give me an example? And if not, say no.
In a way, a parable.
Okay. Anybody else?
What do you mean by sacred?
What do I mean by sacred? Whatever you mean by sacred. Sacred, to me, has nothing to do, has very little to do about being holy. Sacred is about truth. It's about what is important. That's what makes it, to me, it makes a sacred story. We can talk about Bible stories. We can talk, and most people would say, you know, sacred story to me is a Bible story, and they'll come up with a Bible story, and then we can always look at some of those stories from a position of what was not taught us in Sunday school. For instance, Lot. Remember Lot's brother of Abraham? All right. What makes his story sacred? Well, he's in the Bible. He's brother of Abraham. What makes it not so holy? What happens to Lot?
He sleeps with his daughters.
Then you have David. A man after my own heart, says God. What does David do in life? Commits what?
Adultery.
Adultery and then?
And murder.
All right. Any other stories that come to mind?
Samson?
What's his dark side?
Gets tempted.
So does Joseph. Most of the prophets aren't real keen with God at the beginning, so forth and so on. The point I'm trying to make is, if we compare a story to scripture, then you have to keep in mind that scripture isn't always real clean in their stories. Does that make sense? I mean, what, you know, I mean, even Paul had his dark side, right? You know? How about Jesus? Did he obey everything? Mm-hmm. No, he didn't. He disobeyed his parents. Well, of course, it's Jesus, so he can get away with it. Well, never tell that story to junior high class as a Bible study, because they pick up on that real fast. And I used to do junior high ministry for a number of years. Oh, Jesus disobeyed his parents. Wow. Anyway. So I believe that all of us have a story. All of us have a story, and it's called life. All right? We all have a story called life, and our story is about who we are. It's about who we are. We're shaped by our life experiences. The good, the bad, and the ugly. We are shaped by physical, mental, emotional, spiritual things that we deal with through our life, through our journeys. It includes the thoughts, ideas, dreams, our actions, our relationships, our feelings, our failures. The list goes on and on. That's our story. How do we share our story?
We talk together.
There you go. What else?
Interacting with others.
I'm sorry, say that.
The things we do, the way we act.
The way we act, interact with other people, what we talk about, our actions, right? I believe our story is a sacred story. I believe every human being has a sacred story. I believe creation is a sacred story. Where does creation come from? Genesis story, if you go from that Genesis story, God breathed. And it all came to be. Why, you know, do you believe you're a sacred story? Well, let me give you some thoughts on that. Our sacred story, let's see, we're baptized. We're baptized as what?
Children of God.
Children of God, we're a child of God. Sounds pretty sacred to me. Thomas Merton calls that part in us as our true self. Quakers call it the inner light that's in us. Humanists call it identity and integrity. Matthew Fox calls us co-creators with God. And then he goes through all of Scripture pointing that out. Of course, our baptism, child of God. Paul calls us what? Apostle Paul.
Sons and heirs, daughters.
What's that?
Sons and daughters.
Heirs
of the kingdom.
Heirs of the kingdom. Martin Luther calls us little Christ. Right? Sounds pretty sacred to me. So, I am just going to tell you that you are a sacred story. Alright? And the reason I'm going to say that is because part of what I'm doing is part of what I'm doing is planting little seeds in your mind so that when you're done here, if something sparks something in you, you'll go and figure it out for yourself. You're an adult. You can learn. You're an adult. You can learn. So what we're going to do, not everything that I had planned, and because of the time, we will cover, but we're going to cover a lot. So we're going to go quite quickly, and hopefully the computer will be with us. So any questions on that? So I want to start from the position that we are a sacred story. Your story is sacred to you because it's your story, and another person's sacred to you when they tell their story to you. When I was working full-time as a therapist, I used to start off by saying, what brings you to see me? And I got tired of using that one, especially because when they said, well, down the hall, the doctor said I need to come and see you. Okay, fine. Then I started going, I may start with that, but then I would move into asking, what is your story? And usually it was followed by dead silence. Okay, what is your story? Then as trust built between us, they were able to share their story. And I used to always think that I am privileged to be sitting here listening to their story. And that's when I started thinking about their stories being sacred story. It's their story, it's sacred to them. Okay? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And usually I found out that I may have been the first person in their tribe for therapists along the way, counselors along the way, that actually just listened to their story without making much comment except for the fact, could you repeat that again? And I stayed away from, and how do you feel about that type of stuff? So anyway, usually you say that as a therapist when you dozed off for a moment and then try to catch back up. You ask them two questions, how do you feel about that? Or could you say that in another way? Holden has a story. All right, Holden has a story. What's Holden's story?
Renewal Center for the Church.
I'm sorry, what's that?
Renewal Center for the Church.
Thank you. What else?
It's history.
It's history.
Mining Town.
Mining Town. What else?
Gift.
What else? Oh, I like that. What
else? Retreat.
I'm sorry?
Retreat.
Space Away.
Community.
Nice. All these are nice, by the way. It has a story, right? What makes Holden's story?
The people.
The sacred people who come to Holden. All right? Holden has a story. How is Holden's story told?
Word of mouth.
Many ways.
Word of mouth. Many ways. Word of mouth. How else?
Art stories.
Art. Nice. What else?
We tell stories.
We tell stories. Scripture, Holy Scripture, is nothing but stories, basically. Okay, our position as being Christians is to tell a story, right? Story's important. Holden, I believe, has a sacred story. I believe Holden's sacred because it's sacred to me. Okay, it is a place set apart from other places that is real important to me. Okay, so when the fires were coming, my anxiety was quite high. You won't need to go into that. We don't need to go into that. So. We're doing good. Anything else about story? Anything else about sacred story?
I think that Earth has told a story, regardless of whether people are sharing it, particularly with Holden.
Ooh, you want to elaborate a little bit? I think it's great what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's an ecological paradox that Holden exists right now, and I think that the land is telling that story on its own, whether we are listening.
Nice. I believe creation is a story. I've always felt that way.
Yeah. As we learn new things, our old story can change.
Stories change, exactly. Right. Very much so. As we learn new things, stories change. Holden's changed, and yet Holden hasn't changed. Okay? But the story goes on. We could probably sit around a fire some night, and everybody would have at least one, if not several, Holden stories to share. Okay. That's part of what Holden Village is about. Okay. Sacred story. Nice, thank you on the creation bit. That's awesome. Anybody else? All right, let's see if this works. I'm going to show you a clip from Parker Palmer. How many of you are familiar with him? Oh, very nice. I like Parker Palmer. One of my favorite books is Let Your Life Speak, Listening for the Voice of Vocation. I highly recommend this. I read it enough about the third time, and every time something new. You can also go online to his website, and you can click on, don't know what it is, but you will receive a post from him on almost on a daily basis, where he just talks about something, and it's free, you know, so anyway. This one, he talks about the importance of story. It's a short clip. It's part of a series. It's online. If you catch the title of the series, you'll be able to go online and find it. But he's all over the internet. So he talks about when we share a story, our lives leads to something new. Something new happens when we share a story. So that's what he's going to talk about. Hopefully we'll get that going. Okay. Oh, there he is. Almost. Am I going to assume that it's there?
Yes, you can.
Let me know if you can't hear it.
One of the things that I do in the book is to tell a lot of stories about people wrestling with political and social issues. I tell my own story, and I invite the reader to think of his or her story, because I deeply believe that telling the stories of our lives to ourselves and to each other is a political way forward. We spend so much time in our politics sort of throwing our ideas at each other, throwing our political commitments and convictions at each other as if they were weapons. And if I can beam you with mine and knock you out of the ring, then I've won the argument. That doesn't get us anywhere. That gets us into the politics of rage, and the politics of rage is ultimately a death-dealing place to be. But when people sit down and tell the story of why they believe this or that, something new happens. I think one of my most fundamental beliefs is it's impossible to hate or distrust another person when you know more about their story. And the more you know about their story, the less possible it is to distrust or hate them. This has been well demonstrated around contentious issues like abortion, for example, where groups of people come together in a retreat setting. For 2 days, they do nothing but tell each other the story of why they believe what they believe about this very challenging moral and political issue. Only at the end of that retreat are they allowed to say what their position on the issue is. But by that time, hearing each other's stories, realizing that two people who hold quite different convictions on the issue have essentially the same story that took them to where they are. Having that knowledge, being inside each other's stories, gives us a new and more generous way to hold each other's beliefs and convictions. We don't necessarily end up agreeing with each other, but we can end up being a community rather than a combat.
Comments?
Absolutely agree.
Thank you.
There's power in listening.
There is. And it's, you know, it seems like the political camps that you should probably listen to this several times over and over. Okay. Anybody else?
It's not just listening, you have to tell your story.
You have to tell your story. It's the importance of story.
Correct. So participation.
Yeah.
In the dialogue.
It's got to be both directions.
Yeah. So story sharing, and I like that. I'm starting to use the term story sharing more than just telling the story, storytelling. Because storytelling is kind of like a performance, and story sharing means there's going to be a two-way street on this. And it enhances our awareness, self-relations, performance, ethics, team spirit, organizational understanding, and loyalty. The story aspect of our lives. So story sharing can be a powerful basis for spiritual, personal, professional, organizational development and growth. I'm missing my clicker. There you go. So any comments on those two phrases about, this is what important story is about, story sharing or storytelling, whatever, however you want to call it. I've been using story sharing now. Anyway.
It's not a negative, but sometimes people don't want to hear the stories. And it's not a negative in doing story sharing, but that's an issue. It's not a cure-all, I guess.
No, and like what was said earlier, stories, our stories include all that stuff that we don't want other people to know about.
Okay.
But it's still our story. Still our story. And it has no, I don't think it makes any difference about that, whether our story is sacred or not. I believe our sacred story includes all of that, because biblical characters have that whole thing. Okay.
So where does trust fit into this story sharing? Where does trust?
Because
good if
you're question.
Sharing a story, it's something that means a lot to you, and if the person you're sharing it with is not engaged or does not care to listen, it damages your story. Or it hurts it, it diminishes it a little bit.
I'm not sure if it diminishes the stories as well as it diminishes how it may feel diminished to you because they're not listening.
The sacredness of the story to you.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Okay. So, to answer your question, where it's trust fit in this, I think trust is very important to all this. Yeah. I don't know about you people, but I would find it very difficult at times to share my whole life story with somebody I don't even know. I sometimes find it very difficult to share my life story with people I do know. That's all part of who we are.
That's the trickiness I was trying to get at.
Yeah.
I thought of that because I would teach a concept and then use a story to underscore it. Some people didn't want to hear the story.
Why did you think that? I mean, why?
Because they write assessments on my teaching skills.
Oh. I do training for interim pastors, cross denomination, including Jewish rabbis, and we've self-evaluated each session, and every so often, almost every time, tells too many stories. All right, and then the next sheet from the same class didn't tell enough stories, and finally I started out by starting the class by saying I tell stories, and this is what people have told me about my telling of stories. I mean, these are firsthand experiences of my stories, and I tell it doesn't make any difference. Tells too many stories, didn't tell enough stories. Now I'm going.
But the deal is, they know that storytelling is core.
Yes. And I work with, like I said, congregations of the everlasting hope, blah, blah, blah. And it never ceases to fascinate me, as doing this type of work since 99, that congregations don't know their own story. Or I should say, within themselves, they don't know each other's story. Because I will put them into little, you know, we'll have these sessions, and, you know, I'll do some education. Then I'll ask them, you know, some questions of which you will be dealing here. And they will learn things about each other that they haven't learned in 35 years. And it's like people doing announcements in churches. I come in and I say, you have to give your name. If you come up this, give an announcement, give your name. Well, we stand up and no, you don't. That's not hospitality. You come up, you can state your name while you're up there, and you have 30 seconds to say you're not 30 seconds. That's a long time, you know. And yet, well, everybody knows me, they'll say. They don't. 25 years he's been sitting in that pew, but no one knows who his name is. They might know his name, but they never talked to him. That's, you know, and we are a religion of story, aren't we? I mean, we're here because of a story. We are to share that story. And we do a real exciting way of sharing story amongst ourselves, which is kind of sad. Yes.
I'm kind of going back to what Sharon was saying, and you know, the trust issue, and I agree with all of that. There's something, though, or I don't know if "though" is the right word, about hearing stories on the same topic many times, and starting to the first time maybe you didn't appreciate the story, but you know, after hearing it a lot, I'm thinking of, I don't know, was it the early 90s or late 80s, whenever we had some weeks up here about, you know, a lot of gay and lesbian folks came up here and started telling their stories. And I think it did become more powerful or more meaningful as you heard more and more of them. You know, I think if I had just heard one, even if it was a wonderful storytelling, I don't think it meant more as we heard more and more stories. And so I think maybe there's a little bit of trust that gets built up. You still have to be receptive, you know, but anyway.
But you, you said something that's really important. As you keep hearing the story, that trust level goes, and quite frankly, you start probably change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The issue is hearing the story, even for the first time, mm-hmm. just hearing the story. And that's what Parker Palmer's talking about, hearing the story. You know. Anybody else?
That was good.
All right. Clear, honest, telling, sharing is a powerful human strategy. I'm just going to run through these real quickly because I want to do a little exercise with you. Storytelling and sharing strategy has been found, by the way, in clinical studies, believe it or not. Stimulates critical and creative thinking. It increases awareness and understanding. Influences attitudes, behaviors, cultural change. And I'll leave these up for a while for those taking notes. And by the way, if you don't get everything whenever I present my emails on the board, I believe, just email me and I'll be happy to send you anything you need within reason. Create a climate for unity within diversity. Integrate people who are new to particular groups and reinforce cultural values and ethics. I remember being up here at Holden in the late 70s, early 80s, and the big issue around then was ordination of women was still in the air. And when we started using in the prayers, just kind of going he, she, or she, or something like that. And I remember there were people. At that, there was two families, two clergy, who really went after John Schramm on use of that, on the he-she stuff. Yeah. But over a period of time, especially in Holden, something like that. So, anything else? So what I have dropped on you today is the idea that you are a sacred story, that you have a sacred story, a story to share, that Holden has a sacred story, and we share a sacred story of Holden by our actions, by our being here, by going out there talking about Holden and so forth, and living, I think, some of what we have learned or have done up here at Holden. Okay. Does that make sense? All right. We're going to do a little exercise now. Where we're going to start, you're going to share a little bit of your story, a little bit of Holden's story, and then combining the two into one. I'll explain it as it goes. So I need to have you find somebody that you don't know. So no spouses, no friends, all right? Please find somebody and move to that person. It's real simple. Don't be threatened. Trust me, Bill. Trust me, Bill. You'll survive. You'll be all right.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes. I'll go this way.
Find somebody you don't know. Everybody with somebody? You may want to, you're going to be talking back and forth, so make sure you have a little space so you don't hear the others necessarily. Okay. So what I want you to do, here's what we're going to do. I want you to first, I'll run through this first, and then I'm going to explain something to you, right? Is there a three, do we have three?
Yeah.
That's fine. You'll be all right. You're going to introduce yourself, name, family, occupation. Now, this is kind of like cocktail talk, okay? But this is a real brief little skimming of the surface of who you really are, okay? So just making it safe for everybody. I think you can handle name, family, and occupation, if you have them, fine. When not at Holden, where do you call home? What brought you to Holden beside a bus, a boat, a car, a train, or an airplane?
What?
Yeah, what? Figure it out. And what keeps you coming back to Holden? Now, I know we have at least one person who's first time here. You know, good luck on that question. And then what three wishes do you have for Holden Village? So the first couple questions are kind of like about you, right? Name, family, occupation, home. And then we get into your connection with Holden. What got you here, and what keeps bringing you back, and then what? And then it's about mixing the whole two really together. What three wishes do you have for Holden Village? Now, in this time, I'm going to give you plenty of time to do this. You choose who goes first. All right. No interruptions. Just let the person talk about these questions. So you're not getting in your mind ready to jump and say, "Oh, you know, I had that experience too." No. Okay. So let the person talk, and then when it's your turn, you can talk. That's the whole, who said, brought up the whole issue about listening earlier, about active listening, whatever. So, yeah, whatever. Okay? So, I'll give you plenty of time to do that. I brought my iPhone. The only good for it up here is playing games and timing things. Right? Right. So, I'm going to give about 10 minutes for the first round. And if you finish, you can start on the other one. Take your time. And then at the end, here's the last thing. At the end, when you come up with your three wishes, I have pads of paper around here with pens. You can write one wish on one sheet or all three on one. And we're going to paste them up on that. We're going to stick them up to that whiteboard cover right there. And then during the week, if you come up with other wishes, see, the board comes up next week, the holding board. And I'm going to deliver to them, these are the wishes of your people. You know, and see if we get anything done. And, you know, they won't put in a golf course. I tried that once. I don't play golf, but I suggested that. Anyway. All right. Choose who's going to go first and begin. Thank you. So recap. What did you hear today?
Stories are important.
Stories are important. What else?
We all have a story.
Very good. We all have a story. What else?
Our story is sacred.
You got it. What makes it sacred? It's your story. That's what makes it sacred.
It's a faith story. It's a faith story.
It's a faith story.
It still might be sacred with a small s.
It's sacred because it's your story. Just like anybody else's story is sacred to them. And it doesn't matter what the dark sides are, the failures have been, or, you know, the issues have been through your life. It's all part of your story. That's who you are. Okay, that's who you are. So, that's all I have to say. I have another little video clip. You're welcome to stay. It's a woman from Africa. It's real short, about 5 minutes. She talks about the importance of multiple stories rather than sticking with one story. Okay, shaking her head, whatever like that. You're welcome to watch this. Otherwise, dinner has been starts at 5, goes to 6. I think so. Thank you for your time and your energy and so forth. So, give me just a moment. I'll get that video going for those who want to hear it. Hopefully, we hear it well.
Where do you want these wishes put?
Up on that white, right there.
Campus in Eastern Nigeria. My mother says that I started reading at the age of 2, although I think 4 is probably close to the truth. So I was an early reader, and what I read were British and American children's books. I was also an early writer, and when I began to write at about the age of 7, stories in pencil with crayon illustrations that my poor mother was obligated to read, I wrote exactly the kinds of stories I was reading. All my characters were white and blue-eyed. They played in the snow. They ate apples. And they talked a lot about the weather, how lovely it was that the sun had come out. Now, this despite the fact that I lived in Nigeria, I'd never been outside Nigeria. We didn't have snow. We ate mango, and we never talked about the weather because there was no need to. My characters also drank a lot of ginger beer because the characters in the British books I read drank ginger beer. Never mind that I had no idea what ginger beer was. And for many years afterwards, I would have a desperate desire to taste ginger beer. But that's another story. What this demonstrates, I think, is how impressionable and vulnerable we are in the face of a story, particularly as children. Because all I had read were books in which characters were foreign, I had become convinced that books, by their very nature, had to have foreigners in them and had to be about things with which I could not personally identify. Now, things changed when I discovered African books. there weren't many of them available, and they weren't quite as easy to find as the foreign books. But because of writers like Chinua Achebe and Kamara Laye, I went through a mental shift in my perception of literature. I realized that people like me, girls with skin the color of chocolate, whose kinky hair could not form ponytails, could also exist in literature. I started to write about things I recognized. Now, I loved those American and British books I read. They stirred my imagination, they opened up new worlds for me. But the unintended consequence was that I did not know that people like me could exist in literature. So what the discovery of African writers did for me was this: it saved me from having a single story of what books are. I come from a conventional middle-class Nigerian family. My father was a professor. My mother was an administrator. And so we had, as was the norm, living domestic help who would often come from nearby rural villages. So the year I turned 8, we got a new houseboy. His name was Fide. The only thing my mother told us about him was that his family was very poor. My mother sent yams and rice and our old clothes to his family. And when I didn't finish my dinner, my mother would say, "Finish your food. Don't you know people like Fide's family have nothing?" So I felt enormous pity for Fide's family. Then one Saturday, we went to his village to visit. And his mother showed us a beautifully patterned basket made of dyed raffia that his brother had made. I was startled. It had not occurred to me that anybody in his family could actually make something. All I had heard about them was how poor they were, so that it had become impossible for me to see them as anything else but poor. Their poverty was my single story of them. Years later, I thought about this when I left Nigeria to go to university in the United States. I was 19. My American roommate was shocked by me. She asked where I had learned to speak English so well, and was confused when I said that Nigeria happened to have English as its official language. She asked if she could listen to what she called my tribal music. I was consequently very disappointed when I produced my tape of Mariah Carey. She assumed that I did not know how to use a stove. What struck me was this: she had felt sorry for me even before she saw me. Her default position toward me as an African was a kind of patronizing, well-meaning pity. My roommate had a single story of Africa, a single story of catastrophe. In this single story, there was no possibility of Africans being similar to her in any way, no possibility of feelings more complex than pity, no possibility of a connection of human equals. I will say that before I went to the US, I didn't consciously identify as African. But in the US, whenever Africa came up, people turned to me, never mind that I knew nothing about places like Namibia. But I did come to embrace this new identity, and in many ways I think of myself now as African, although I still get quite irritable when Africa is referred to as a country, the most recent example being my otherwise wonderful flight from Lagos 2 days ago, in which there was an announcement on the Virgin flight about their charity walk in India, Africa, and other countries. So after I had spent some years in the...
All right, that's all I have for now. Comments on that? You get the idea from her that, you know, the danger of a single story. When we learn more, we learn more about the others. I like that video. I watch it all so often.
One quick response. I think sometimes we don't realize that we've got a wrong story, and a lot of our prejudices are based on a lot of
on the wrong story.
On the wrong story.
Unfortunately, this is all the video I have of this.
Yeah.
But you can find this on the internet.
It gets at that.
Anyway.
She's the author of Americana.
Oh, is that right?
Which is a terrific book.
It's a terrific.
It really is.
Wow.
She
did not know that.
Turned out to be a great writer.
I can't even pronounce. How do you pronounce her name? Okay, fine. Thank you. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, people. Have a good evening.